It's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to echo what many of the other speakers have said, to thank the organizers for their invitation, and also how fruitful it is that we are finally bringing together all the classes of evidence from different sites. I first went to Egypt in 1988 at the invitation of David Peacock to work on the pottery at Mons Claudianus so that he could focus on the quarries there. And I owe him a great debt for introducing me to the Eastern Desert. Now, all the other speakers have already given very good introductions to most of the sites and a lot of the key issues in looking at the differences of supply to the different type of sites. And shown here are the two main quarry sites that I'm going to talk about, Mons Claudianus and Mons Porphyrides, and then the port sites, Myos Hormos and Berenike. And I'm peripherally going to also talk about the roads because they're so important in trying to join things up. I am going to focus today on the Roman pottery. We're just in the very early stages of the study of the Ptolemaic pottery from Berenike, and I don't really feel I have anything to contribute. We're going to learn so much more from Samut than we can from Berenike at the moment. And I'd like to talk about supply on a number of different levels. There is, firstly, the supply of the actual ceramics that served as utensils in the desert. And so that's one issue. And then there's the issue of the foodstuffs that were carried in the ceramics, which is slightly separate. And finally, within the supply, we can look at issues coming from both the East and the West. Now, we've already learned a lot about the quarries, and we're going to hear in more detail about the ports this afternoon. I'd like to just here show you the important deposits that contributed to the typochronology, the data typology for the Eastern Desert, because it's based on certain key deposits from these sites. And firstly, of course, it all starts with Mons Claudianus and the dated ostraca, which enabled us to create a typology, I think, that would otherwise not have been possible because so much of the material is confusing, is mixed. So I'm going to talk about Mons Claudianus in more detail in a moment, and I'm just going to summarize the evidence from the other sites. Oh, this is quite a nice, unusual photograph of Mons Porphyrides because it was after a rainy season, and you can actually see flowers blooming and some green shrubbery, which was not how we normally saw it. But Claudianus was important for adding some edges that I didn't get from Mons Porphyrides was important for providing these edges that I didn't have from Claudianus. And that was the earlier first century, as we saw in the Bradford village with the Panaean yesterday, and also my first experience of the late Roman period, where we got late 4th, early 5th century deposits. Cusair, we got these Augustan deposits, which were very, very important. And although those are the earliest deposits we have, as you've already heard, we have hints of Ptolemaic occupation from Myos Hormos, Cusair, El Kadim, but this would be under the amphora deposit where we had we hit the water table and we weren't able to go further. So we don't actually have that evidence. And we had from Myos Hormos, we had a series of textbook savaks. I really had never seen anything like this. And it so confirmed the patterns I had been seeing from the other sites. We had an early first century Sabak, we had a late first century Sabak, and we had a mid-second century Sabak. So they were very important in reaffirming the chronology that I had already established from Claudianus and Porphyrides. Miles Hormus is also very important for deposits of the first half of the third century. Now, finally, from Berenike, as you know, we now have these Ptolemaic deposits, but we also have a very important late Roman sequence. And I think while we do have Sabak at Berenike, and John Peter Wild has already talked about it, one of the main contributions of that site is that we do have many in situ assemblages, which gives us a different type of view on pottery supply and use than we get from these other sites. And here we have here a temple that I'm sure Steve will be mentioning this afternoon, where we particularly had in situ pottery. Okay, so back to Claudianus. We had very rich material from there, and particularly from the South Sabak, and these amphorae and some cooking pots are from the South Sabak. And from the dated deposits that we had, I was able to construct dated phase groups for the mid-first century, which I referred to as Neronian because we had the Neronian evidence from the Hydruma, the Trogenic period, mostly from the South Sabak. There was a late Hadrianic deposit and a Severan deposit that probably went to about 235. We then had this group of very difficult material that I called Trogenic Plus, because the upper layers of the South Sabak had been reworked in the Antonine period. And although most of the pottery in those layers was still Trogenic, there was very little Antonine pottery in them, I had to find a way to separate them out. And unfortunately, it was a very large amount of pottery. And you will see if you go through the catalog how many types are assigned to the Trogenic Plus period. Oh, next, what I'd like to do is just show you some of the key chronological markers for the different periods, which have been identified from different sites. And the first type is the spouted vessel or strainer, which we have a division between these types down here that just had ledges, here also, and the more classic ones, which seem to start in the late first century in the Trogenic period with the actual strainer. Although in most cases, the strainer has been chipped away, so they clearly were just a nuisance more than anything else. In the second century, we have a couple key markers in the mid-second century. The first is the painted thin-walled wares from Aswan, which I'm not showing. But secondly, from the Antonine period on, we have the costrels. And these have been really useful in being able to divide the mid-second century, sort of a dividing line. And they're also important in terms of the food supply to the site, because many, many of them had stoppers and clearly were used as transport vessels to the site for foodstuff. Many of them have pitch in them, which makes it even more interesting that the few examples of analysis of the contents undertaken by Wim van Meer and Sheila Hamilton Dyer actually shows one of the pitched costumes to contain salsamenta made of Nile fish. So it's very interesting to think that these small containers were carrying fish sauce. And also, it's very counterintuitive to what, as pottery specialists, we normally say. We normally say that if vessels are pitched, they must have carried wine. So either they were reused, or we have to rethink this sort of key concept that we use. Three of these vessels, you'll have to probably take my word on this, actually have writing on them. And I presume these were address labels to whoever they were sent to at site. They're certainly not legible anymore. And this is something we see on the amphora. So they are acting as a small amphora, really. And it's not only the costrels, because we have here a very small jug that also has a stopper in it. So it would have brought some sort of food supply to the site. Now, during the second century, there seems to have been some crisis in the pottery supply at Mons Claudianus. And this is reflected in an industry that started before the second century, but really became more common then, of the reworking of amphorae into small vessels. And you can see here we have all stages of production, from the removal of the amphora spike. Well, actually, we have some markings here, and here's some little perforation, sort of like tear here, that's how I see it. And it resulted in these beautiful vessels, drinking cups, and also these stoppers, and other vessels as well, but these are some of the more easily recognizable types. Another feature of the pottery during this period was extensive mending, so it needed to be reused, such as this is a rope lashed through matching holes, and then it's covered with pitch in order to seal it. So there seems to have been some sort of problem with pottery supply, particularly from the Hadrianic onwards at Mons Claudianus. And we do also see reworking of pottery at Mons Porphyrides. It's not on quite such a large scale, but we do still see the whole sequence. And we also see at both sites the reuse of this material for stoppers and gaming pieces. And this, to me, is one of the most poignant assemblages that we have from Mons Porphyrides, because whoever was living on this pass between Porphyrides and, but that should be Badia, excuse me, the pass between Porphyrides and Badia, not Berood, would have had a very dull, lonely existence. Maybe there were two of them there and they were able to play games. At the ports, we see none of this reworking of pottery. We still see the reuse of amphorae, such as this oven that was created with spikes, and we see the reuse of amphorae on all the sites, but the lack of reworked pottery distinguishes the ports from the quarries. Now, coming to the third century, we're very, very lucky at Cusser to have extensive third century deposits. And the key marker for this period is these so-called Dressel 30 amphorae, which were actually produced in many places, including North Africa and Tunisia. And we have many from Tunisia and smaller numbers from Gaul. At the port sites, at Mons Porphyrides, I think also at Claudianus, and we have an overwhelming number of them from Cob Marfua, which is part of the emerald mining complex, which Steve may talk about later today. So this is a really important type, and it enabled us to take the dating of Miles Hormos up to the mid-3rd century. After the mid-3rd century, we have a few other types that can be useful for dating. We have this very thin-ribbed bowl, which seems to have started in the 3rd century, the 3rd century AD, or maybe the late 2nd, but may continue into the late Roman period. And we particularly found these in the East Sabacc at Mons Porphyrides, which is paleographically dated by Wilfrid to the end of the first half of the 3rd century. So that was a very important piece of evidence for us. There are still big gaps in this chronology, which we are very slowly filling at Berenike, I think. And they're not represented by large deposits. They're very small deposits. And this is something that just recognized in the last season in 2015. And it's a collection of North African, Egyptian, and a hollowfoot amphora. And I think while these might start in the 3rd century, they may fill this gap that we've had thus far at Berenike. By the late 4th century, we're on very firm ground. We're back to the well-known Mediterranean types, well-dated. And at Berenike, we don't feel we go much beyond the beginning of the 6th century. And many key types, such as Phocian red-slipped ware and late Roman amphora II, are completely absent. So these are good dating indicators as well. The typology of the AE3 amphorae has been really important because it is the most overwhelmingly common find on, I think, all these eastern desert sites. So the ability to get some sort of basic chronology for it has been very, very helpful. Again, the 2nd century, these become important. There's an example down here. What is very interesting is that these are almost absent from Berenike, which contributes to my idea that Kusair was much more important in the 2nd century than Berenike. I probably have to also reconsider whether this is just a different supply system and the same kilns were not reaching Berenike as Miles Hormos. And then, of course, we have the late Roman small Nile silt amphorae and the larger late Roman 7. Now, as I said, the amphorae constitute between 40 and almost 80% of the deposits throughout the sites I've worked on in the eastern desert, and that's certainly true of Claudianus. If you look at the percentages of imported amphora, you will see it's very, very small. Despite the smallness of the sample, it is very important because these particular vessels would have contained foodstuffs and particularly wine, as you'll see, of a higher quality than was carried in the AE3, and therefore they would have been more expensive and probably a higher status would have been attached to them. Now, much to my surprise, when I compared Jean-Pierre's data from the desert sites, I got almost identical results, and I actually expected completely different results. I thought that the quarries would have much less and the roads that were servicing the ports would be more in keeping with the ports themselves. And this is something I'll come back to later. Now, although they were very, very small, although there were very, very small quantities, you can see here there was a huge range of imported amphorae at Mons Claudianus, and it was probably the type of range, although not the quantity that one finds in Mediterranean ports. Similar types were found at the ports. Additions related primarily to chronology rather than to additional types being present. And it was clear from the quantity of material that is found on the site that it was not only for export, but also for massive consumption within the site. These amphora here belong to the Italian Dressel 2-4, which can be equated to the Italica in the Periplus and the Nicanor, and which occur across the Indian Ocean. So we can see them going from Alexandria all the way to Sri Lanka. A second amphora type that Wilfried showed yesterday that can also be equated to the documents is this this Dressel 2-4 made in Syria, which equates to the Laticani. They too occur across the Indian Ocean, but not in such large quantities. Now, I'm going to skip over the finewares because they really are essentially the same patterns in fewer quantities than the amphorae. But I'd like to show you some of the finewares that only occur on the port sites. And these are the glazed wares, both glazed wares from the Roman world and also glazed wares that reached Berenike from Mesopotamia via the Persian Gulf. We have other finds that reached Berenike by the Persian Gulf, including here's some more of the glazed wares, a bitumen-lined transport amphora, and this stunning piece of Sasanian glass, which came from the surface and was identified and photographed by Renata Kowarczyk. So thank you, Renata. Now, very quickly, I'm going to go through the Eastern imports here. And what I'd like to point out is that there's a variety of vessel types. And just as in the Roman world, different vessel types represent different kinds of transactions. The same is true with the Eastern goods. So these jars, for instance, probably carried something to the Red Sea. They're very, very common. They're sometimes lined. Whereas these cooking pots from East Africa are much more likely to represent personal possessions, and they were brought to the site by people from East Africa so that they could continue cooking in the ways that were familiar to them. And we can see a similar pattern of different kind of vessel types from all over India. Now, if we look at the roads, we've discussed these in quite detail yesterday, so I don't think I need to go into it. But most of the non-Roman imports are exclusively found on the port sites, particularly in any quantity at Berenike and Myos Hormos. We do have an Indian cooking pot from Vettis Hydruma. We do have quite a few Indo-Pacific beads from Saket, and Sandrine Alain has published some rouletted ware from Coptus. Now, we talked a bit yesterday about an Aksumite pot from here and a number of ostraca calling for pepper and frankincense, published by Alain. So we can see that there are some things filtering through past the ports, but we don't have anything past Coptus. So it's very much trade-oriented association. Now, I'm going to just let you read the general observations because I think I'm over my time while I just make some conclusions here. Basically, I'm trying to unpick the different patterns for the imports that come from the Mediterranean, from the West, and the imports that come to the East. And all this has to be placed within the context that we've discovered over the last 25 years of the sort of strict regulations that existed in the Eastern Desert for transporting material. So I think that the explanations of these different patterns are different for the Eastern goods and the Western goods. Now, very recently, Rodney Ast and Roger Bagnall have suggested that there may have been some taxation paid off in Berenike and that local markets were available there for Eastern goods. I mean, this could explain some of the material, Eastern material, that filters onto the roads. And apart from two peppercorns, does not filter onto the quarries. The Mediterranean goods, however, present a really different pattern, and I think the answer lies in what's happening in Coptis, and particularly in the social organization at Coptis, which we need to know a lot more about. And so the similar and very small quantities of Mediterranean amphora found on the road sites and in the quarries suggest that they were being bought in Coptis, and this, maybe the same sort of quantity was available. But at the ports, much, much more of this Mediterranean material was available. And I think these patterns need a lot more work. And so I'll just end by saying that regardless of the different quantities and how they reach the different sites, it's certainly the presence of the trade sites and the presence of the military in the Eastern Desert that resulted in such a rich range of material being available. And I do apologize for overrunning. Thank you.